From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said today that President Trump's family and his aides should stage an intervention for the good of the country. She said he is crying out to be impeached after she says he stormed out of an infrastructure meeting yesterday and then promised not to work with Democrats as long as they continue to investigate him. Here's Pelosi at the press conference earlier today.
The president has a bag of tricks, and the White House has a bag of tricks that they save for certain occasions. They don't necessarily apply to the occasion, but they're a distraction, which is his master of distraction. We will all agree on that.
Joining us now is Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy.
So this press conference today from Pelosi was unusually long, first of all, but what else did she say?
She said that the president needed to get back to being focused on his job, and that would include, on the one hand, responding to the congressional investigations that are going forward and that two courts now have said should go forward are within their rights and should be shown the documents they're trying to get from an accounting firm on one hand and from a bank in Germany, on the other hand, about the president's tax and business background. And on the other hand, the president should be willing to go ahead and work with Congress, negotiate with Congress, talk to both parties in both the House and Senate about moving legislation that both he and the Congress want. And that would include infrastructure and disaster relief, prescription drug prices, trade deals, and all the usual budget and spending bills.
But he says that he doesn't want to do that while these investigations are going on. Here's how the White House is responding to what happened yesterday and what Pelosi is calling a tantrum by the president and the Democrats' response to it. This is advisor Kellyanne Conway on Fox News this morning.
Their two-track strategy is nonsense. They can choose whether they want to investigate or legislate, and what's more important to them. We all know Speaker Pelosi is under enormous pressure from some folks in the rank and file who are demanding that she get the caucus together and start impeachment proceedings.
It seems like the White House is goading the Democrats to go forward with impeachment, and Pelosi has been hesitant to do that. How is that disagreement inside the Democratic Party at this point?
There's a lot of reason to believe that Pelosi's motivation here is, at least in part, to keep control of her caucus. There are firebrands who want to begin the impeachment proceedings yesterday. Mm-hmm. And there are more moderate members who would like to keep the impeachment process at arm's length, perhaps keep it in the future as a prospect, pursuing the various investigations that we mentioned earlier that are already underway, but doing it without using the I word.
We've talked about the fact that an impeachment inquiry could make it easier for Democrats to get their hands on some of the documents that they've been asking for and haven't been able to get. But these two federal judges ruled against the president this week and said that congressional Democrats should have access to the president's financial records. Is that going to change anything in terms of what the Democrats do now?
I think it's already changed with the attitude of a lot of the Democrats, and it's absolutely added to Nancy Pelosi's resolve to go the route that she's going at the pace mm-hmm. that she is going on that route. It adds weight when these judges stand up for the legitimacy of Congress's inquiries here. And if they are supported on appeal, that's a big if, they're both already being appealed by the White House, and they might very well reach the Supreme Court. But if they do prevail, they raise the prospect that after many years of resisting this, the president is going to have to hand over to Congress some of his tax and business records. And that's the one thing that seems to have bothered the president more than anything else, back to the start of Robert Mueller's investigation mm-hmm. into the 2016 campaign and in all of these other congressional inquiries.
I want to ask you about one more thing, Ron, which is a moment that happened on Capitol Hill yesterday. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin was pressed about when the $20 bill is going to change to have Harriet Tubman on it instead of Andrew Jackson. That was supposed to happen next year, 2020, and Mnuchin indicated it won't happen until after President Trump is out of office. Why?
Out of office, even if he should win a second
right.
term, Jeremy. So they're putting it way down the line. And Mnuchin said that there were design issues. There were a variety of reasons why they couldn't make the change right away. Maybe they could do some of the other dollar denominations, but not the 20. And in that particular case, he said there was going to need to be quite a bit more time and design work done. Now, let us put alongside that the realization that President Trump has not been a fan of the switch from Andrew Jackson to Harriet Tubman from President President Jackson, who was also a slave owner and someone with an extraordinary record of persecuting Native Americans, mm-hmm. to a person who is known as an abolitionist. And we do know that Andrew Jackson's portrait hangs on the wall by the president's desk in the Oval Office.
Right. And also kind of hard to believe that the United States government would be unable to make the sort of security changes to dollar bills and change the face on one of them at the same time, and it would take so many years. But we'll watch this play out. It's going to be interesting. Ron Elving, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
John Walker Lind, the California man known as the American Taliban after his capture on a battlefield in Afghanistan a little while after 9/11, was released from a federal prison in Indiana today. His arrest and imprisonment over 17 years ago stunned Americans. He was not foreign-born. He was from here, but he pled guilty to providing support for the Taliban. His plea deal called for a 20-year sentence, but he is out early for good behavior, which has raised a lot of questions, especially from the family of CIA agent Michael Spann, who was seen interrogating Lind in a famous photo from Afghanistan, then was killed during an uprising of Taliban prisoners. Seamus Hughes is deputy director of George Washington University's program on extremism. Professor Hughes, you've said you're hearing John Walker Lind is just as radical now as he was when he went to prison?
Yeah, so when he got sentenced in 2002, he was very repentant. Although in recent years, we've heard that he is a strong supporter of the Islamic State. He's written letters to various journalists advocating for the Islamic State. He has preached to other inmates about how important it is to support terrorist organizations. So he still clearly holds these extremist beliefs.
In fact, haven't there been some intelligence agencies, I think the New York Times reporting yesterday, who actually feel that they've been picking up on this?
Absolutely. The intelligence agencies are quite concerned about this.
Well, let's just ask, though, how does this happen? When somebody gets released for, especially for good behavior, don't they have to go through some kind of a board or some kind of an assessment?
They do, although we have to think of good behavior in the terms of a prison. Good behavior means going into your cell at the right time, not talking back. It doesn't mean holding radical beliefs. And so, unfortunately, he checked all the boxes when it came to that, but he still holds his extremist beliefs.
Well, but has anybody, in other words, you are saying you have heard this, others are saying they have heard this. But has anyone formally heard this? In other words, the judge who decides or a board that decides, have they asked him about his radical beliefs?
I'm not sure about the judge, but I know the probation services are aware of his extremist beliefs and are concerned about it and are trying. I think that's one of the reasons why we saw such a restrictive or intensive conditions placed on his release. I think that both the U.S. attorneys and the FBI are quite concerned.
Let's talk about those restrictions. He can't get a passport. He can't travel internationally. His internet use will be monitored. He can't ever read or see any material having to do with extremism. He can't meet or speak with anyone who's connected with any kind of extremism. Very restricted life outside prison. But we were wondering, who monitors that?
Yeah, it's kind of a spattering of a bunch of different agencies. So the FBI will have an ongoing investigation, the Bureau of Prisons, pretrial services, U.S. Attorney's offices, and they'll all have to coordinate on the same page.
Look, hundreds of people have been arrested and imprisoned for jihadi-related terrorism crimes since 2001. In other words, joining various jihads. Some of them have already been released and have had complete life conversions, have in fact worked with the U.S. government. But are you worried about these different releases?
I'm worried about the fact that the U.S. government doesn't have a plan when it comes to this. There's no de-radicalization or disengagement programs within prisons. And to be fair, the probation restrictions are – there's no uniformity into it. So, you know, Lynn gets a number of restrictions, but another guy who gets out gets completely different restrictions. Now, I should say that, you know, we've had at least 50 to 100 people that have been released in recent years, another 50 to 100 that are getting out in the next 5 years. Most of these individuals move on with their lives. And we've seen the rate of recidivism be relatively low when it comes to crimes of terrorism. But people like Lynn are somebody that you have to be worried about. And to be fair, it's also a resource issue. You're going to have FBI agents watching him, probation services, and it's going to be a strain on the system.
Well, it costs money and personnel to have someone jailed as well. And just to push back a bit, you can have opinions. He can say that he supports groups that he feels are just. He can't act on it. So is it fair to keep someone in prison just because they may have a view?
No, and I think that's the issue the Bureau of Prisons is dealing with right now. It is absolutely fine to have radical beliefs. It's not fine to have violent radical beliefs. You can't hold a person indefinitely, but you can be concerned about them indefinitely. And so they have to do that balancing act.
Well, and just one last question. A former inmate who knew John Walker Lynn, spent time with him at the same federal prison, said he never heard Lynn espouse any kind of support for al-Qaeda or, you know, any terrorist organization or indicate any leaning towards violence. He thought he was awkward around people, but never heard anything. So is there a possibility that because there's a thinking that he had something to do with the killing of a CIA agent that's never been proven, that there might be people leaning more on him when you have an inmate saying, I didn't see anything?
Yeah, I mean, I understand people, they look at his history and say he's absolutely probably still radical. But I think we have to put it in the context of his writings, too. So he's written a number of letters to The Atlantic, to NBC, talking about his support for the Islamic State. And so it's one thing to tell an inmate you don't believe it. It's another thing to tell the media you do. And so they're going to have to square that circle.
Yeah. Seamus Hughes, Deputy Director of the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. Professor Hughes, Seamus, thank you.
Thank you.
We've reported here on people claiming their pets as service animals when they're not, to get them on planes and stuff. Kind of shameful. We've also reported on wonderful organizations that train real service dogs to help people with physical and emotional disabilities. One is NEEDS in Western Massachusetts. Inmates at a correctional facility spend months training NEEDS dogs to do things like turn a light switch on.
Nudge. Yes,
nice.
Go for it.
Very good.
Or open a refrigerator door and get a dumbbell, which may one day be a water bottle. He pulls the string, opens the fridge door, and gets the dumbbell.
Nudge.
Close the door.
Good boy, closer. Hold. Hold. Give. Yes. Good boy. Good fridge, buddy.
The dogs are also trained to detect medical attacks or sadness, using their bodies to absorb a fall or pain. But it turns out there's a cottage industry of scam service dog providers, what our next guest calls a Wild West. People, well-intentioned but unequipped to train dogs, and those who are outright con artists. In 2012, Illinois officials sued the company Animals for Autism, which took thousands from families and never provided dogs. There's a bill being considered in Massachusetts to address the problem. And the Associated Press did a deep dive. What they found is disturbing. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from a victim of a fake service dog sale. But first, David Favor, law professor at Michigan State College of Law, editor of its Animal Legal and Historical Center website. And Professor, you called this the Wild West. Why?
Because it's unregulated. Anybody can be a participant. There's low entry. It's all over the internet. People really have to be careful of scams.
Well, what about certification or registration or licensing? We were reading that one of these companies had to surrender its license in Colorado. What kind of license?
I suspect that was just a breeding license because, to my knowledge, there's no formal governmental process requiring licensing.
And this notion that, you know, you can just bring a dog into an area, is there confusion, you know, for people maybe between a pet and a working dog?
Oh, there's tremendous confusion. The two big things, a service animal is an animal under the Americans with Disabilities Act who has been trained to do something on behalf of a human. It could be opening a door, listening for sounds, and they're the ones that are allowed to go around in the public areas with their human. The other category that people confuse is emotional support animals who, under the Federal Housing Act, are allowed to be with humans within their housing only if they have a letter from a medical person that says that they need an emotional support animal for their psychological well-being.
And by the way, both of those get abused by people who claim those dogs when they aren't actually playing that
yes.
role.
Yeah. Yeah, we got fraud going on at all kinds of levels here. Yes.
Yeah. There is an International Association of Assistance Dog Partners who, you know, say a service animal should have a minimum of 120 hours of schooling over 6 months or more. What is the kind of training that produces a real service dog?
Well, I would have to agree with that organization. Usually it starts with the young dog, and you have to train it like you would your pet at a high level of obedience. Then you have to begin to train it for specific needs, either autism or PSD or whatever the particular need of the human might be. And that would take months in and of itself. So the organization you referred to is one of a number who are trying to create a private system of registration for those that are doing the good job, but there's no law that requires that to happen.
Well, people might point to the Americans with Disabilities Act.
All it says is that they must be trained. That's the only language that's in the actual law itself. It doesn't say how they're to be trained, doesn't do anything.
And also, the Department of Justice prohibits local and state agencies from requiring that the dogs be registered?
Well, it's that the federal law preempts the area so that while state law can come into existence, it can't overturn the federal law. So since the federal law doesn't require a formal registration system, a state law can't put it into place to trump the federal.
And why do you think this is happening, that there are so many of these companies and so many scams?
Well, it used to be a very quiet enterprise, but with the service and assistance animals and emotional support animals that have been in the news so much for the past, say, 3 years or so, all of a sudden people with bad intentions or ill-informed have woken up to the idea there's all these people out there and they all need animals to do it, and they see how long it takes to get the animals, and so they're looking for ways to cut corners. So the visible entry into the system is just too easy.
We've watched dogs be trained over the course of like a year and a half, and it can cost up to $50,000, which is why, you know, nonprofits are doing this and trying to raise outside money to do it.
Right.
What small family operation can afford $50,000 per dog over a year and a half?
They can't, no.
Yeah. What more do you want people to know from your research?
Well, you really shouldn't use any organization that you don't get personal references from somebody that you trust.
Yeah. David Faver, a law professor at Michigan State College of Law, also the editor of its Animal Legal and Historical Center website. David, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Well, let's bring in Rebecca Peluso. She's one of 52 people across the country who filed complaints against the North Carolina-based Rycon Service Dogs Company, run by Mark Mathis, who claimed he trained big Briard dogs for children with autism. Rebecca said she paid $14,000 for a dog that not only wasn't trained to help one of her twin daughters, Ella, who has autism, but wasn't trained, period, and got out of hand. North Carolina's attorney general filed a motion to dismiss Mark Mathis's bankruptcy filing. The local station CBS 17 reported he spent much of the nonprofit's money on restaurants, a cruise, dating websites. Rebecca joins us now from her home in Jacksonville, Florida. Rebecca, what did his website say that made you think this was a safe bet?
Well, reading that he was certified as a North Carolina state-approved service dog trainer with a specialty in autism service dogs for children really stood out to me.
Yeah, I imagine it did. And what did you think when you heard, as we just did, there is no such thing as a state-approved service dog trainer?
It was flabbergasting. There's really no regulations in this industry.
Yeah. And why did you want a dog so badly? What is the issue you'd hope the dog would help with?
Well, number one for my daughter is her running. She's ran off before, and that puts her in danger. And we would hoping it would open a door to us to be a part of the world, part of our own community, by being able to get out of the house and not worry about her running off as much or her meltdown she'd have in stores. A trained service dog can do deep pressure therapy to help calm a child during these meltdowns.
Deep pressure therapy, they can actually lean their paws or their heads on places to reduce that anxiety?
Correct.
Yeah. So you're hoping this would change everything. How did you come up with that money?
I sold my dining room table. Yeah. I sold my bed. I had many yard sales. I sold numerous personal items.
Yeah. You trusted. Suddenly you're getting a call from him, as were a lot of other families. Come get your dog. The training wasn't finished, he said, but he was shutting down. And he said it was because of people complaining unfairly about his business. But you get the dog, bring the dog that's ultimately named Puzzle home. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, she should have been close to finished training. Got her home. She immediately went after neighborhood cats. Our corgi was in boarding. Corgi comes home. She goes after the corgi. Mm. She's nipping at my children. Took about 3 weeks, got her weight up so she looked like a normal dog. But she has a high prey drive, these dogs, which means they go after smaller animals, which most animals are smaller than them.
Yeah. Well, that's no good.
The end result was the fact when she went after the other twin, jumped up on her, tried to pull her shirt off, knocked her down and clawed at her legs, leaving marks all over her legs. And the dog ultimately had to be rehomed to an experienced Briard home.
Yeah. You looked around and you found a woman who got homes for Briards and did for this for Puzzle, thankfully, because it's not Puzzle's fault. So what was this like when your twin Emma was knocked down by what was supposed to be a service dog, Puzzle, that was supposed to service her twin, Ella? What was that like?
She was scared to death and crying. She said she didn't want to be in any room that that dog was in anymore.
Have you seen real service dogs in action? Have you seen what they can do?
I had only seen probably what the general public had seen prior to the situation, you know, out and about.
Well, we've been talking about this. It's an amazing thing what these dogs can do after months and months of training. I can't imagine knowing what might have been possible, how that feels to you.
It was like having the rug ripped up from underneath of you. He stole hopes and dreams from these children and from these families.
Look, we should say that Mark Mathis has written to the state of North Carolina after complaints from you and others. He says it's part of a coordinated effort by a political Facebook group. They were started to protest service dogs. They turned its sights on Rycon. They are opportunistic families. And the cost of, you know, running this kind of a business was just not sustainable, and that's why he closed down. You say what?
Well, I guess it's not sustainable if you're taking the money and using it for personal expenses and purchases.
Yeah. And by the way, how does Ella take all this in? This was supposed to be her guiding light.
She's heartbroken. She thinks the dog went away to get better so it can be her service dog.
Yeah. Very, very sad. And as you well know, there are stories that are horrific. There is a family that talks about a service dog that they had to take away from a young girl. Who knows if there's a connection, but she soon killed herself. What would you like to see happen here? I know you want to get your money back, but what overall would you like to see happen?
I would like to see some federal regulations come into play. There should be some mandates that they have to meet to be a service dog company.
I understand you're getting a golden retriever just to have a companion dog. Are you going to try to train it as a service dog or get it trained?
He's going to be a started service dog. He won't be have all the tasks trained that we need. My daughter's actually named the poor dog Ray of Light Taco Pudding Party.
How do you call that?
He'll be called Ray for short.
Well, Rebecca Peluso, we wish you the best of luck, you and Ella and your family.
Thank you.
And by the way, she told us she can't afford to train Ray now, but hopefully in time.
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
Tesla shares are bouncing back today after an alarming week of losses. Just this year, the electric car maker's stock has dropped nearly 40%, with half of that coming in the last month. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hello, Jeremy.
So an analyst at Citigroup says there's now a 40% chance of a full bear scenario where Tesla stock would drop from its current price of $194 a share down to $36 a share. What is going on? Why is Wall Street losing faith in its former darling?
Okay, wait for it. I believe the potent Musk is losing its olfactory appeal.
Elon Musk, right? The head of Tesla.
All right. Elon Musk, CEO, get it. Tip your waiters. Look, Tesla, it's been such a high-risk, high-reward story and a lot of debt and a lot of cash burn. But as long as you keep posting amazing growth and wowing the planet and having a stock price to mortgage, you're hot. But if any one of these ingredients is missing, the whole Tesla bull case falls apart rather quickly.
And Tesla has had a lot of issues. There was a recent test in Connecticut. Consumer Reports found the new autopilot feature on the Model 3 performed like, quote, driving with a kid behind the wheel for the first time. That doesn't sound good. In Norway, one of Tesla's strongest markets, cars are being apparently delivered with dents and sloppy paint jobs. What is going on?
These are the daily pains of running a global automaker with a,
and a new one.
Yeah, I mean, a $35 billion market value still and sky-high expectations of a change-the-world culture, and all this at a time of serious technological change. If it's not the battery technology or getting the price down to size, scaling it, it's autopilot concerns or China or the CEO Elon Musk making surreal claims on social media and running afoul of the SEC.
At the same time, there are a lot of people who still see a lot of promise in this company. And even with the recent drop in the share price, Tesla still has a valuation that's similar to Ford.
It's amazing. I mean, it's a fraction of the age of Ford Motor Company and has a sliver of its sales, yet they're both valued by investors at around $35 to $40 billion. And that's because investors have been willing to pay up for dibs on what Tesla can and might become with the mass adoption of electric vehicles.
Back in 2013, Robin, there were reports that Apple was going to buy Tesla for $240 a share. They were trying to do that. Do you think that now that the price has come down, they may try again?
Yeah, Wall Street has this Apple put that many investors romance daily. I mean, yes, Apple has no shortage of cash or market value to spend on this splurge. It's trying to do cars, but they've never done anything remotely at the price of Tesla, and it's unclear how much they want to take on car fires and autopilot accidents and short sellers and, you know, Elon Musk's special daily hell.
Now, we said that Tesla stock is sort of rebounding a bit today. Overall, the market, at least in early trading, was down a lot today. And there are big concerns about the trade war. When it comes to Tesla, in China, the electric vehicle market is three times that of the United States. Elon Musk just opened a factory in Shanghai earlier this year to get in on the action. How is the trade war complicating those plans?
Yeah, it really has Wall Street worried this week. A prominent Tesla analyst today came out and said China uncertainty could by itself prompt Tesla to miss its all-important 2019 vehicle delivery target, which we see affects its cash flow and cash burn and ability to go it alone. So Tesla's kind of become like a gas guzzler in this sense.
Hmm. And yet, you know, with all these problems, I see more Teslas out on the road when I go out on the road. I see them all over the place now.
Let's see how many there are in 5 or 10 years.
I guess. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure.
The annual Scott Joplin Ragtime Festival is coming up in Sedalia, Missouri, and there's a lot to celebrate. This is one of Joplin's first and most influential hits. The Maple Leaf Rag brought Joplin, a traveling musician, an income of a penny per purchase of that song, but it gave him a steady income for life, and it became one of the definitive pieces of ragtime. Culture writer Fran Hoffner says the Maple Leaf Rag and other ragtime music that Joplin wrote transformed the American musical landscape, and maybe her as a young girl. Fran joins us from New York. Fran, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
And talk about this because we know you as a percussionist.
Yes.
Those of us who follow you.
Yeah. Well, my first instrument was the piano. And I took piano lessons as a kid. And any early pianist knows that you spend a lot of time doing rudiments and technique.
Furlies.
Yeah. And all of the sort of stripped down classics made easy. But I remember being maybe 2 years into my piano education and finally getting, you know, an easier arrangement of The Entertainer. And that transformed how I viewed playing piano. It was like no longer a chore.
Yeah.
And suddenly it was really exciting.
Well, you say it was fun, but also you had relatively small hands, so it was kind of hard because people think, oh, it's, you know, it's not serious classical music. So it's got to be easier, but it was hard to play.
Oh, it's very difficult to play. I had small hands then. I have small hands now. And there are a lot of jumps in the bass line that requires one's left hand to just be bouncing back and forth with a huge amount of accuracy and precision.
Yeah, let's listen to a little more of Maple Leaf Rag. And tell us, why is it called ragtime?
It's called ragtime because the tempo can be a little shaggy, and it becomes, you know, the pianist's choice when to speed up, when to slow down. There's a lot of suspense and humor in being able to mess with the tempo.
Yeah, you call it organized chaos.
Yeah.
And just to Joplin a little bit, he wanted to be taken more seriously. He wanted to be considered a classical musician, and in reading about his life, one of the saddest things to read is that he wrote a couple of operas. One, Tremonisha, a magazine at the time, called it the American opera. It wasn't successful in Joplin's time, but it was performed in the 1970s, so at least he had that. Another one, this breaks my heart. He wrote an opera about Booker T. Washington's historic meeting with Teddy Roosevelt in the White House, but that was lost. So there is some sadness to Joplin's stories we're going to hear. But eventually, classical musicians did play his music. Here's Elite Syncopations, played by Itzhak Perlman and Andre Previn. Fran Hoffner, what do you like about this?
It's so joyful and interesting, and it sounds difficult in this really challenging and tricky way. It's like listening to someone finish a puzzle, if that makes sense. I just used to listen to this on repeat when I was a kid.
Really?
Yeah, I used to just put it on. I could listen to this for an hour. It's so pleasant to me.
Well, and let's hear a little more now. And tell us more about Scott Joplin, born 3 years after the Civil War ended in either Texas or Arkansas, the son of a former slave. He himself worked as a laborer on the railroad, went north, became this traveling musician, made a huge splash, as we said, with the Maple Leaf Rag at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. A huge national craze. Talk about ragtime's popularity.
Well, ragtime originates in the American South, and as well as in St. Louis, which is where Joplin resided most of the time, and goes back and forth between St. Louis and Chicago, where you have this burgeoning ragtime movement, this jazz movement, all of these black musicians coming together and collaborating on a genre of music that is often rooted, you know, in slave hymnals or in folk, American folk songs. And it's interesting because you think of the cultural center of America at this time as potentially being New York City, but it's this really incredible Midwestern movement of music that spreads across both directions of the country.
And let's listen to one song in particular, because there were often stories in the songs. Let's listen. This is Swipesy Cakewalk. So a cakewalk is a pre-Civil War dance performed by slaves, you know, exaggerated to mock slave owners. And the prize for the best was a cake. And you are hearing that sense of drama in this?
Yeah, I think there's a real dark satirical tone to Swipesy Cakewalk. It, you know, sounds playful maybe from a distance, but when you get up close to it, there is this really like heavy, haunting bass line to it.
Well, it is a remembrance from the son of a slave of slavery. There's also a sadness in his song Bethina, a concert waltz. Let's listen to a little. It's not going in the direction we thought a ragtime piece would. What's the story here?
Joplin wrote this after his wife passed away, and she died only weeks after they got married.
She's just 20.
Yeah, there's this real air of tragedy to this piece of music. I think Joplin gets categorized differently because ragtime is playful and therefore not serious, even though there's so much classical music that is playful. And so Bethina has kind of become the calling card of like, well, Joplin could be serious if he wanted to, but it's all serious. Just some of it is more upbeat, and this piece has a, you know, a different tenor to it.
Yeah. Jazz came and ragtime fell out of favor, came back into favor big time in the 1970s, in part with this song. I can just see a young Fran Hoffner playing this.
Yeah, it was my favorite thing to just like plunk down on the piano and start playing. I think what felt revolutionary about Joplin's music to me as a young pianist is it was also the first songs I could memorize. They had this really sing-songy, repetitive quality that made learning to play them like building muscle memory.
Yeah. This, of course, was the theme song for the 1973 Paul Newman, Robert Redford movie, The Sting. A few years later, Joplin would posthumously win a Pulitzer Prize in 1976. But he was pretty much all but forgotten decades earlier when he died in 1917, 48 years old. What's your sense of him, his life, especially in the context of the time that he was in, moving through the music industry the way he did, and his legacy?
I mean, I don't think he was given the credit he deserved during the time when he was alive, but Joplin totally revolutionized American music and American dance hall music and sort of the beginning of American popular music. And, you know, it says a lot that he was able to travel with his music. Even just being at the World's Fair feels like a major accomplishment for an American composer, let alone an African-American composer during this time. But people poached from Joplin left and right. I don't think he died particularly wealthy or well-regarded and, you know, fell not out of favor, but out of the zeitgeist until the 1970s. And only now do we recognize him, if we do at all, as this pillar of American music. But he ought to be up there along with, you know, Copland and Berlin and Bernstein.
Okay, kind of a Mount Rushmore there of American composers. Well, I tell you, I still would give anything to hear Scott Joplin's musical imagining of Booker T. Washington's meeting in the Oval Office with Teddy Roosevelt in 1901. It riveted the nation, a black man, you know, in the White House. But this was at a point when he was having some hard times. Some receipts had been stolen from a show. He couldn't pay some debts, so some of his possessions were seized, including that music. It's lost forever. However, in gratitude for Roosevelt for having that meeting, he wrote the piano reg, A Strenuous Life. We'll go out with that. A culture writer, Fran Hoffner, writes about music for WQXR in New York and talks about it with us. Fran, thank you.
Thank you so much.
In the UK, Prime Minister Theresa May is under a political death watch after failing to deliver Brexit. The question isn't whether she will step down, but when. And her Conservative Party is expected to take a beating at the polls today in the European parliamentary elections, while the brand new Brexit Party gets rewarded. Joining us now is NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Jeremy.
And so let's start with Prime Minister May. First of all, what is the sense there about how much longer that she can hang on?
Well, I was out, you know, you were mentioning the elections. I was out this morning traveling around talking to voters. And most people that I talk to think that she shouldn't last very long. And most of them, almost all of them, there's some sympathy for her, but they would like to see her move on very quickly. I was up in a place called Watford. It's about 30 miles north of London by train. And I met a guy named Warwick Bird outside a church, which was a polling area. And I asked him about May's future. And this is what he said.
Non-existent. She be out by the weekend, I would imagine. She's very stubborn. She won't compromise with anyone at all within her own party.
Now, the 1922 committee, this is a committee of parliamentary backbenchers in the Conservative Party. The leader is going to go talk to May tomorrow, I think, to try to get her to set a resignation date. But honestly, Jeremy, what's really remarkable here is there's no sign the prime minister is budging, even though she seems to have little, if any, power left. What 10 Downing Street has said is they still intend to bring back some kind of new Brexit withdrawal plan for a vote, but they're delaying that. Jeremy Hunt, the foreign secretary, this morning said that the prime minister will still be in office when President Trump comes here from June 3rd to June 5th. Mm-hmm. The question is, will May have already announced her resignation and simply be a caretaker at that point? We'll have to see.
But she did lose another high-profile cabinet minister just yesterday. Tell us what happened.
She did. And Jeremy, remember, this is the 36th minister she's lost. Has resigned during 3 years, which I don't know my British history, but that sounds like a lot of ministers to me. And what happened there is the woman's name is Andrea Leadsom. She's the leader of the Commons, which means she manages government's business in the House of Commons. And what she said is she could no longer support the prime minister because she felt the prime minister was now offering, as she did earlier this week, a road to actually a second Brexit referendum, which infuriated Brexiteers in her party as well as other Brexiteers in the Labour Party, and that's why Leadsom decided to resign.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the European parliamentary elections, which are going on today in the UK. What are people telling you about that?
Well, I think the big story is exactly what you hit on earlier, and that is the Brexit Party. And this is a remarkable political story in this country. The Brexit Party is perhaps 6 weeks old, and it is way ahead in the polls, ahead of the Labour Party and the ruling Conservative Party. And it's run by Nigel Farage. If you would remember back 3 years ago, he was one of the main campaigners for the Brexit referendum. He's very charismatic, and they're way, way out ahead. When we were talking earlier this week, I was at this Brexit Party rally. It was very boisterous, and I met a woman named Frances Elliott, and she told me that she's very angry with the way Labour and other people in the parliament are not supporting Brexit. And this is how she put it to me.
I'm absolutely gutted because I'm Labour through and through, but it was the push for the second referendum. I felt very insulted. I think our mainstream politics have sold out the British people. We've not been respected. We've been called Nazis and fascists.
So Frances was sitting next to her sister, June Sally. She's a lifelong member of the ruling Conservative Party. And Frances said it was remarkable that even though they're politically different, they found themselves in the same place earlier this week. Here's how she put it.
And this is also the only party that my sister as a Tory and me as a Labour can come to together. I love that. I really love that.
Okay, so this Brexit Party is giving people a way to come together, obviously, if they're in a divided family. But let me ask you this, Frank. There are still a lot of people in the UK, especially in London, who don't want to Brexit and are hoping that there is a second referendum. What about all those people? Are they going to vote today for people in the European Parliament?
They are, but it's a little more difficult because the Labour Party is split, so they don't have a really clear message. And so the kind of energy, the Remainer vote here is split. I talked to people who've said earlier votes we've had, they're going to support the Liberal Democrats who are clearly for Remain, Labour split. So you're going to see a diffusion of the Remain vote. But what's going to really stand out probably on Sunday night when we get these results is how well this new party, the Brexit Party, has done.
Okay. And so let's bring it back around to what's going to happen with the leadership of the UK. If May leaves, when May leaves, who's going to replace her?
Well, it's going to be like the Democratic nomination for running against Donald Trump in 2020.
It's going 24 to be a host people of people. Right.
Jeremy, everybody is going to get in on this. The person everyone's going to be focusing on, though, is already the front runner, Boris Johnson, hardcore Brexiteer, former London mayor. He's a bumbling guy. He's politically incorrect, but he's also erudite and he's charismatic and he's way ahead in the polls in the Tory party membership. Most importantly, most people in the Tory party membership think he's the person who can win the next general election.
And his hair looks just like President Trump's hair, too.
Kind of.
So there's
there's a lot of they're both big, outsized personalities and hardcore populists.
That's NPR's Frank Lankfitt in London as voters go to the polls again today in the European parliamentary elections. Thanks, Frank.
Happy to do it, Jeremy.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.